Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Independent media outlets are out with scathing reviews of the national media's coverage of presidential hopeful Senator Bernie Sanders. Salon's Simon Malloy writes that Sanders is bringing out the media's true colors. His campaign reveals how skewed our attitudes toward wealth and taxation have become. And in the Columbia Journalism Review, Steve Hendricks writes that most stories declared, quote, this crack can't win. He writes, quote, the trouble with the consensus is the possibility of evidence to support it. This crank actually can win is nearer the mark. But having settled on a prophecy, the media went about covering Sanders so as to fulfill it, end quote. So why did the New York Times bury Tuesday's official campaign launch on page 21? The story was less than 700 words, compared to the front page over 1,000-word stories about Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Hillary Clinton. Joining us to talk about coverage of this and other issues is Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine. Yes focuses on solutions to some of the biggest issues of our time, and on the cover of the latest issue is Alicia Garza, Black Lives Matter. She gave us a hashtag for love and justice. And Sarah joins me in studio. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So glad to be here.
Great to have you. I should say that Sarah is in town for a conference, Anything is Possible, and it's at Pier 35. She'll be speaking tomorrow at noon and again on Sunday at 11. That's Pier 35 in San Francisco, and it's called Possible. Let's work together. Possible4.us. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Dave Leventhal. Dave leads the reporting team of investigators focusing on the influence of money in politics at the Center for Public Integrity. The center is a nonprofit news organization with a mission to serve democracy by revealing abuses of power, corruption, and betrayal of the public trust. And Dave is out with a story about Uber's influence on Capitol Hill. He writes that 275 politicians and political committees together spent more than $278,000 on over 7,000 Uber rides during the 2013-2014 election cycle. He also writes about very powerful lobbyists working for Uber, including top presidential Barack Obama advisor David Plouffe. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rose. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. And we're also talking about media coverage of the election in Spain. In July 2013, Ada Colau was hauled away by riot police for trying to occupy a Barcelona bank. Today, the 41-year-old is the mayor of Barcelona and the first woman to hold that position. Colau is the first of the indignados, or angry ones, to win office. When news broke, she said it is a victory for David over Goliath. Today's guest, Miguel Ángel Morado, wrote about the victory and what it means for Spain's political landscape for The Guardian of London, where he's a contributor. And Miguel Anjo joins us from Madrid. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Friday's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Dave Leventhal with the Center for Public Integrity, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, Rosa, I'd like to go off the beaten path a little bit, quite literally, to highlight a story written a couple of months ago by a reporter and author named Josh Ells. He writes a story headlined "The Loneliest Road in the World." It's a sumptuous account of this 700-mile journey down a gravel road cutting through the wilderness of Labrador in Canada, something very close to my heart. I've traveled in the Arctic a good bit, and he just tells a remarkable tale about going from point A to point B over one of the most fascinating highways in North America, perhaps even the world. And it appeared in Men's Journal, frequent reading for all of us, but I would very strongly encourage people to check out this this article, a great tale for anyone who has an adventurous spirit.
That's great, and I'm guessing it's a fairly long article.
It's quite a long read, and but it reads like something that's about 200 words long, and you wanted to go on forever. It's a really, really great tale.
And is this available online?
It is.
Okay, great. Thank you. It sounds really interesting. We will link to that at yourcallradio.org. That's Dave Leventhal. He's with the Center for Public Integrity. And what about you, Sarah? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I want to send a shout-out to one of my colleagues, Tracy Dunn, who put together a lovely infographic for our current issue called Make It Right. The infographic is a nation built on the back of slavery and racism. It looks at specifically what ways were wealth transferred from African Americans to white America over the course of U.S. history, beginning with how slavery was actually at the foundation of modern capitalism. I think a lot of us think of slavery as sort of a little agricultural backwater in the history of the United States, but actually the whole cotton trade and then the slave trade itself involved many people, including in the North, where people would like to disassociate themselves from slavery. And really formed the foundations of modern capitalism. And then the infographic really traces how the economy was, over time, extracted wealth from African Americans and benefited white Americans. So it sort of lays the groundwork for a really interesting conversation about what do we owe, what does reparations mean, given that history.
There's so much great information in this. The income gap has not budged since 1970. For every dollar of assets white households have, black households have a dime. She writes that slavery launched modern capitalism, as you said, and turned the U.S. into the wealthiest country in the world. The result, African Americans have not been able to get a foothold in the economy.
That's right. And we often think of the safety net programs. The right-wing narrative has been that that has primarily benefited African Americans. But in fact, there's a whole series of safety net programs that actually excluded African Americans, whether those were business loans, farm loans. A lot of African Americans got displaced from their land because they couldn't get the same loans that white farmers could get, or even Social Security. There's figures about how many blacks were ineligible for Social Security compared to whites. So over the course of our history, we've had this long series of discriminatory policies that result in the kind of poverty we now see in black communities.
Do you feel like this is getting more attention? Because Fresh Air had on the Economic Policy Institute's Richard Rothstein, who's also been on this show, talking about the history of housing policies in the U.S. and touching on some of the things that you just mentioned.
Well, I think it is. The reason that we did this issue called Make It Right was because of, obviously, all the turmoil in Ferguson and then in Baltimore and lots of other places. It was specifically around the killing of unarmed black people, but it really pointed to a much deeper issue, which is I think some people had hoped that after the election of a African-American president that we could declare a post-racial society and we could all move on and we wouldn't have to talk about this anymore. And those events and the Black Lives Matter movement just made it really clear to Americans overall, I think, that we actually have a huge amount of work to do. But there's this kind of sense of, well, what is that work? How do we go about doing that? So this issue of, yes, we've really been delving into that question. How do we go about looking deeply enough at our history of racial exclusion and violence to actually begin the healing process?
Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. There's a photo of Alicia Garza on this month's cover wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt. Meet the woman behind Black Lives Matter, the hashtag that became a civil rights movement. And what about you, Miguel Anjo? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, in this context of the huge scandal involving FIFA, that is the international governing body of football, or as you call it in the States, soccer, European football, well, my attention was drawn to a piece in the Guardian website, which is called The Prison Where Murderers Play for Manchester United. And this is written by David Goldblatt. And what is interesting about this piece is that it is about a prison in Uganda called Lurisa Upper Prison, where apparently there is a very sophisticated system of football or soccer teams playing against each other, a whole system of registration, transfer of players, basically a FIFA inside this prison. And what is interesting about this story is that it seems to be far more honestly run and less corrupt than FIFA itself, even though this is a prison where people who are serving time have done really, really very bad things. And still, they managed to organize a championship and a league of soccer, which, as I say, is run in a much more clean way, apparently, than FIFA. So quite a lesson. And it is interesting also because it's very well written. It's a good piece of journalism. Yeah. And it's very long. in fact, belongs to a section of the Guardian website, which is called The Long Read. And it's a very good idea, is that if you have a website, so you're not restrained by paper, by the amount of paper you can use, you can write as much as you like. So for me, as a print journalist, this is a wonderful idea, that finally you have the chance to explain yourself without any limitations in terms of size of your piece. And it's a really interesting, it's very good, very well written, as I say, and very interesting for these times.
So kudos to The Guardian. The Guardian also had an amazing piece looking at the number of immigrants from Nepal that have died in Qatar at a rate of one every 2 days last year. So this is getting a lot of attention, and we will cover this issue on Friday's Media Roundtable either next week or the week after. So thank you for that. Miguel Angel Morado is a columnist with The Guardian of London, and we will put links to all of the stories mentioned at yourcallradio.org. Miguel Angel, let's dive in and talk about what's happening in Spain. You're joining us from Madrid, and this is getting a lot of attention. Ada Colau became the first activist from the Indignados, Spain's Occupy movement, to become the mayor of Barcelona. She's 41. She's also the first woman, and it's been amazing to read about her. In July 2013, she was hauled away by riot police for trying to occupy a Barcelona bank that was foreclosing on homes. She testified right after a bank executive and called him a criminal. Tell us a little bit more about Ada Colau, again, 41, first female mayor of Barcelona.
Well, actually, I know her personally because we were in the same radio show a couple of years ago when she became, at that time, more and more famous because she ran an organization devoted to fighting evictions, home evictions, which became a common occurrence in Spain during the last few years because of the economic crisis. Lots of people lost their homes. I have to explain that in Spain we have a terrible mortgage law, which actually is more than 100 years old. It's a very old law, very cruel, is Dickensian. It means that, for example, if you stop paying the bank, if you stop paying your mortgage, not only you lose your home, like everywhere else, but still the debt is not cancelled. You still owe the money to the bank forever. So basically, not only do you lose your home, but you lose everything you have, and you become, well, almost a criminal. So she began organizing a group to fight these evictions. They have people all over the country, and whatever they knew there was going to be a home eviction, they would go there and try to avoid it. And sometimes with success, even, for example, at certain point, in certain cases, policemen joined them and didn't follow the orders to evict people. And that is how she became famous. And now, as you say, she's still not the mayor. There's still a vote to have on that because she won the election, but she doesn't have a majority, so she has to make a pact with all the parties. She has plenty of parties to coalesce with because the left and the nationalist left in Catalonia has had also good results in those elections in Barcelona. And also here in Madrid, where I am in the capital city, another list, which is very similar to that of Ada Colau, called Ahora Madrid, Now Madrid, has been a close second and will probably have the chance to elect a mayor. So, again, another woman, in this case, a much older woman, a judge, someone who is very, very prestigious, called Manuela Carmena. And so it's the two main cities in Spain that will have mayors drawn from this Indignados movement, which is considered as radical left by many people, but it's actually a group of people who are worried about the crisis, the economic crisis, and its effects on people.
There's also been reports about Ada Colau and her supporters doing good old-fashioned knocking on doors, talking to people who might be evicted or have been evicted. We're facing the same thing here in the Bay Area, Miguel Angel, especially in San Francisco, where the rents are skyrocketing. A lot of people are being evicted. And we've got an election coming up with a very well-connected mayor, and a lot of people say no one will run against him because they cannot raise the money that it takes to now run for the position of the mayor of San Francisco. What does money look like in Barcelona? Is it similar or is it wildly different, money in politics?
Well, it's different. I guess you still need a lot of money to do politics in Spain, but probably not as much as you need in the U.S. for many different reasons. And in fact, this group that won the election in Barcelona, which is called Barcelona en Comú, was actually created a year ago only by 12 people, and they began gathering. You need a number of people signing a petition in order to run for the election, but that was very easy for them. They got 30,000 people to sign for them, and they didn't want loans from the banks, they didn't want any, which is what most political parties in Spain do. They actually take loans from banks. They didn't want to do that because they didn't want to be hostage of those banks, so they crowdfunded the campaign. And whether they had money or not, well, it seems that for them it has paid off because, well, they have won for the first time an election in Barcelona.
Dave Leventhal, you cover money and politics for the Center for Public Integrity. What strikes you about the differences between what it takes to run for office in the United States versus what it takes in other countries?
Oftentimes, when you look at the campaign schedules and the experiences of candidates overseas, and mind you, it is difficult to paint too broad a brush here, but in many of the countries, there is the commonality that elections are shorter, that it doesn't take nearly as much money to run for public office, and that the sort of permanent campaign that we've come to see develop and become reality in the United States over the past many years is just something that is simply foreign to, say, people in the UK, even in Canada, in many other countries in particularly Western Europe. So there's definitely a disconnect. I always have to laugh when I talk to a politician who lives and works in a European country, and you explain the U.S. system to them, and of course they know a little bit about it, but they're just shaking their heads saying, wow, yeah, this seems like it's not from across the ocean, but from another planet. So whether you like the U.S. system or not, it definitely is a very foreign system to many of the politicians and political practitioners of countries overseas.
Sarah, how does Yes Magazine go about covering these issues? It seems like the victory or possible victory of Ada Colau is a perfect story for Yes Magazine.
It is for sure. I mean, one of the things that we're really interested in is especially with this big presidential election coming up, a lot of times all the air gets sucked out of the room in terms of the social movements because everybody is suddenly trying to work for a particular set of candidates. And especially at the national level, you know, the candidates from the Republican and Democratic Party both tend to be really sucked into the whole corporate world, into supporting Wall Street and not being able to not willing to take on some of the really big issues like poverty, like inequality, mm-hmm. like the climate crisis. So we're really interested in looking at some of the local races, and that's where the mayoral race is so interesting, because actually we just did an issue last year on cities, because that's where so much of the real leadership is coming from in the United States right now, is cities are willing and have to take on these issues. They can't pretend that inequality and evictions aren't happening, you know, and that their cities aren't experiencing the heat island effects and aren't getting inundated by flooding as we just saw in Houston. They have to take care of things now. So we often see the real leadership coming out of the cities and sometimes at the state level. And so we cover that kind of innovation because that helps other people get the same idea that they could do that too.
Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. Dave Leventhal is an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And Miguel Angel Morado is a contributor to The Guardian. And Miguel Angel will be with us for about 5 more minutes. If you have any questions about what is happening with the political situation in Spain and the indignados, the angry ones who are starting to win office and get a lot of media attention, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Miguel Anjo, how are these issues covered in the media in Spain, specifically, you know, poverty and home foreclosures?
Well, they are covered extensively, no doubt, because they have been very prominent in the last few years. Spain is a rich country, but the economic crisis has hit very hard, especially the middle classes, middle-lower classes. There's been an impoverishment of all sorts of people, not just necessarily those who are in the worst economic position. And this has been a shock for the Spanish society. So I have to say all the media is concerned with this. Of course, the way in which they interpret it is different and differs mostly for political reasons, where the media is more conservative-oriented. They tend to support the government's line that the economic situation is improving, that all has to be blamed on previous governments and nothing in the austerity cuts, the cutbacks affected by the current conservative government. On the other hand, of course, progressive media tends to see it in a different way. They think that it is precisely not just the crisis, but the policies pushed forward by the conservative government, policies of austerity, and by the European Union as well, are to blame for most of this misery. So you have a great concern, world coverage, but of course there's an ideological take that affects the way in which this is reported in the media.
And how are these candidates, these anti-austerity, anti-eviction candidates, covered in Spain? Because we're going to talk in just a few minutes about how someone like a Bernie Sanders, who's running for president, is covered in this country. Basically, you know, this crack cannot win. I mean, that's what we're seeing in so many media outlets. What does it look like in Spain?
Well, there were seen sympathetically at the beginning when they looked just like a very small minority group. So they had a lot of positive coverage. But as they became more and more popular and it became very clear that they could challenge the two main political parties, both the conservatives and the socialists, well, things changed. And now you could say that there's a constant campaign against them, trying to present them as, well, some sort of a Venezuelan invasion or something like that. So now the coverage is mostly negative, but it wasn't so at the beginning.
Sarah, before we let Miguel Angel go, do you have any questions for him about media coverage of these issues in Spain?
Yeah, I'm wondering how much the media covers the popular movements and the efforts at the grassroots to make a change, because so many of the media just focus on the horse race. So how much do they get into the people who are really trying to take on these big issues?
Well, you're right. Until these local and regional elections, they did cover more the social issues related to these movements, and they were treated as social movements. Now, after the elections in the last few days, we see more and more that the horse trading is what matters, who is going to be the major where, and all that sort of thing. And I think that will even become more clear in the coming months, because we have an all important general election towards the end of this year, which will be the crucial moment, because it's not just city councils that are up for grabs, but the government of Spain itself. So I anticipate a lot of tension in the coverage of Spanish politics in the coming weeks and months.
Well, Miguel Angel, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Miguel Angel Morado is a contributor with The Guardian. You can find his reporting about the shifting political landscape in Spain at yourcallradio.org. After the break, we'll talk about coverage of Senator Bernie Sanders' run for president with Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine, and Dave Leventhal, reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Ben Stewart about his new book, Don't Trust, Don't Fear, Don't Beg, The Extraordinary Story of the Arctic 30. It chronicles the imprisonment of 30 Greenpeace activists who were thrown into a Russian jail for protesting oil drilling in the Arctic. He says the Arctic is in grave danger. We'll talk about what's being done to save it. That's on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be talking about coverage of presidential hopeful Senator Bernie Sanders. We will also talk about solutions-oriented reporting. Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. Yes focuses on solutions to some of the biggest problems of our time. And Sarah, I should mention, is going to be speaking at a conference that starts tomorrow, What's Possible. It's at Pier 35 in San Francisco. She's speaking tomorrow at noon. And then on Sunday at 11, you can find information at yourcallradio.org. Dave Leventhal leads the investigative reporting team at the Center for Public Integrity. The center is a nonprofit organization with a mission to serve democracy by revealing abuses of power and betray of the public trust. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're a Yes Magazine reader, which I am, I love the magazine, and you have any questions for Sarah about how they've been able to stay so strong during these times, we'd love to hear from you. Also, what are your thoughts on solutions-oriented reporting? And if you have any thoughts about Senator Bernie Sanders and his run for the president and how that's being covered in the media, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So, Sarah, we know how Yes Magazine would go about covering a Bernie Sanders. It would be about the issues, about, you know, he talked about hungry children. He said something at his campaign. He said, why do we have 26 different kinds of underarm deodorant and we can't solve childhood hunger? He talked about taxing the rich. He talked about corporate power, the media. I mean, all of these issues. But when you look at how the media are covering him, the New York Times gave him 700 words on page A21 compared to over 1,000 words and front page above the fold coverage for Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and the rest.
Well, Rose, I think that's such an important point because the New York Times calls itself the paper of record. So they're supposed to represent objective journalism. But what that example shows really clearly is that they have their own worldview, their own biases. And anybody who falls outside of that is considered an outsider and a long shot. And they're just not going to get the kind of coverage. It's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you don't give someone coverage as a serious candidate, how will they get their message out unless they have a lot of money? And then they're beholden to the people who give them a lot of money. So, yeah, I think it's an excellent point. And I think, you know, what we really need is to question what the New York Times' own bias is. Are they so uninterested in a conversation about income inequality that Bernie Sanders is trying to raise up that they're just not going to let that conversation take place? You know, another thing that Bernie Sanders is talking about that I'm so impressed about is that he's raising the question of climate change mm-hmm. as a national issue. And a lot of other candidates put that as either they're in denial completely, a lot of on the Republican side, or they're just not willing to talk about it. And yet it's an existential threat. It really does threaten our immediate future as well as our children's future. I mean, the California drought is probably an example of that.
Right.
The huge storms, actually, President Obama is finally talking about how the big storms that we're having, you know, a lot of those are associated to this. And this is just going to get worse. So these are really big problems. They're not necessarily ones that there are big money to, you know, that want to address that. It's just what ordinary people need. But we do need it.
And again, we have to give kudos to Steve Hendricks with the Columbia Journalism Review. It's a long piece. He details how the coverage differs between Senator Sanders and everyone else. And Dave, he also points out that Times reporters declared high in their piece that he was a long shot for the nomination and Clinton was all but a lock. But none of the Republican entrants got the same long shot treatment, even though Paul, Rubio, and Cruz are polling, you know, at the eighth, seventh. But the Republicans are, we often hear fresh voices. This is just what the conservatives need. What are your thoughts about this, specifically on the New York Times?
Well, the Democratic primary and the Republican primary are the dynamics of both are very different. So that is a reality that's hard to get around. There could be 15, even 20 semi-legitimate Republican candidates, and now we're having conversations about how debates will even be conducted because there are just too many to fit on the stage. The Democrats don't have that kind of problem, but as you point out, Hillary Clinton is really truly taking up much of the oxygen in the conversation simply because of who she is, former First Lady, former Senator, former Secretary of State, former presidential candidate. But at the same time, it's important to note that she's not exactly doing herself any great favors with the media that's covering her. In fact, a lot of reporters have been grumbling, and a lot of editorial pages have been writing quite pointedly about how inaccessible she is to reporters, that she's not answering their questions, that her events from state to state all around the country are very staged, are very well produced, and completely not off script. So for somebody like a Bernie Sanders, or for that matter, Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, who's going to jump into the race tomorrow, Jim Webb, Lincoln Chafee, a few of the others who may on the Democratic side get in, there could be an opportunity for them to kind of knock Hillary Clinton off her very lofty position right now, both in the polls and of course, in the conversation in the press and otherwise.
The Politico had a good story. Dems view Sanders as a bigger threat than O'Malley. They quoted some Clinton operatives who spoke off the record and said that they're more afraid of Bernie Sanders than O'Malley because so many, you know, progressives in the party are excited about Sanders. But even the Politico lead said one candidate is 73 with a shock of wispy white hair and a famously rumpled demeanor that makes him look more like a mad scientist than a politician. I mean, this is the norm in a lot of the coverage.
You know, the thing about Bernie Sanders is, and I say this noting very clearly that he is nothing like Ron Paul in any way, shape, or form. However, he's suffering from a similar problem that Ron Paul, who ran for president in 2012, had during his run in trying to challenge Mitt Romney and some of the other Republicans. He had an incredibly passionate base of supporters, people who would just go to the mat for him, would do anything for him, but he had just a simple difficulty building much beyond that very energetic core group of supporters. Bernie Sanders has a core group of supporters, again, incredibly energetic. His challenge right now is going to simply be the same thing as Ron Paul had, which is building beyond those people who feel very passionately and strongly about him.
Sarah?
I think that may be true, but the reality is that the things that he's talking about are things that Americans care a lot about, things like income inequality. He has this great statement on his website that talks about how the Walton family of Walmart owns more wealth than the bottom 42% of Americans. I mean, that for one thing, that's a huge problem. It distorts everything about our society, including our politics, as you well know. But the other thing that's kind of interesting about his choice of Walmart is that Hillary Clinton used to be on the Walmart board of directors. I don't think she still is.
No.
But she was. And so there's a real difference there. There's this one person who's talking really about ordinary people like you and me, people who are struggling, and the fact that huge numbers within the middle class, you know, between the housing, the cost of housing, the cost of education, the cost of health care, are struggling every day. And he really gets that. So I can see why that would be a threat to the Hillary Clinton camp.
And what about the substance? What about those issues and how the media are covering these at a time when people, these issues are really galvanizing people?
Well, for whatever reasons, and at least for some media, because of their own corporate ownership, they don't really want to talk about some of those key issues. You know, one really good example of that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm. which very few in the media are talking about. And yet that's almost like a constitution that overrides the kinds of bills and legislation and policy that we might want to make on the local level. For example, buy local policies can be overridden. You know, corporations can sue local governments for profit loss if they do something as radical as prohibit a toxic waste dump. So those kinds of issues are essentially taking away major parts of our democracy. People aren't talking about it within the mainstream, but and Hillary Clinton has so far avoided taking any stand on it.
And on the TPP.
Exactly.
We have an email from Tim who says the reason the New York Times and other outlets are minimizing Sanders is that he's a real threat to the dysfunctional, corrupt status quo when up to 25% of revenue for television comes from super PAC negative campaign ads. There's no incentive for them to promote or even mention campaign finance reform. Dave, you focus on that issue. What do you think about that comment?
Social media is going to be a game changer this time around. So, yes, is TV, radio, other online outlets definitely going to make a lot of money off of this election? Absolutely. At the same time, too, I point out an example at the Center for Public Integrity. We produce a series of facts about every candidate when they announce for president. Our one about Bernie Sanders, 12 things you need to know about Bernie Sanders, far and away has been the most shared, has been the most popular, and the most circulated. So that does speak, I think, to some degree and in one little way to the power of people sharing information amongst themselves, peer-to-peer, if you will, as opposed to just simply relying on corporate media or big media to get their information. There are so many different outlets and so many different sources where one can get information now, and it's just simply a wildly different game from a media landscape standpoint today than it was a generation ago, even 10 years ago.
You've got some really great facts in this series, 12 things to know about whether it's Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Rick Santorum is up there right now. How do you go about finding this information? So, for example, on Sanders, you wrote, who wrote this piece? Let me just look at this. Carrie Levine, your colleague, wrote, Sanders' biggest annual fundraiser is usually a $25 per person sunset cruise on Lake Champlain. Sanders has pushed campaign finance reform and called on Congress to overturn Citizens United. I mean, there's just these great facts in here about all of these candidates.
Yeah, for this entire series, we've plumbed public documents, federal filings, fundraiser invitations, whole variety of sources. Our colleagues over at OpenSecrets.org have provided a lot of great information. They do a lot of very nuts and bolts campaign finance work, which is fantastic, and cobbled that all together to paint a picture of sort of a political and financial biography of each candidate. And in our opinion, these facts are things that everyone should know about any of these candidates, because, of course, all of them are going to be in the headlines for many months to come.
You also have Senator Sanders' top five contributors since 2009 are all unions, with the sheet metal union giving him the most, $27,500. That is Dave Leventhal. He leads the investigative reporting team at the Center for Public Integrity. It's a nonprofit news organization with a mission to serve democracy by revealing abuses of power, corruption, and betray of the public trust. Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. Yes focuses on actual solutions. We're a big fan of solutions on this show to some of the biggest problems of our time. Sarah will be speaking at the What's Possible conference. It's taking place in San Francisco at Pier 35. She's speaking tomorrow at noon and Sunday at 11. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you've got any questions for Sarah, if you're a Yes Magazine fan, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you would like to talk about coverage of Bernie Sanders and money in politics, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, or just the presidential election in general. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Pat in Santa Cruz. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show. Hello, Pat. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. Maybe I'm unduly attuned to things that the candidates say when they don't seem to be thinking about what they're saying, but they do affect me. For instance, there's what appears to me to be a very grandiose quality about Hillary Clinton, and I draw that as an example of that. When she was asked by the reporters, "Will you take reporters' questions?" she said, "I'll take that under advisement." And there's just something so detached about saying that it really grated me, because that's one of the main issues. How come she's talking fluff and not talking about specific issues like TPP that you mentioned? And I would like to know from the guests whether they feel that people get annoyed by these things that the candidates say that are not what they intend to say, but they just kind of slip in there.
Well, thank you. Sarah, do you want to take that one first?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that a lot of the coverage you see in the media is about the personal style of candidates. And, you know, different candidates are more or less likable, and there's a lot of discussion about whether you'd want to have beer with this one or, you know, watch the game with that one. And so I'm a little cautious about reading too much into statements like that. I'm especially cautious when it's a woman who's a candidate, because women are given a lot less slack in being assertive, shall we say. If they're not assertive enough, they're considered too feminine to govern. If they're too assertive, they're called names that may begin with a B, and not be very polite. So I think I'm very cautious about that. You know, if I was to give you my own personal reflections on it, I just like anyone else, I could say who I personally am attracted to. I like Bernie's style. He seems like a real regular guy, and he seems really authentic. But I really try to check that with their actual policy pronouncements, and especially with their records.
Dave, what are your thoughts on that?
Hillary Clinton is in a position of strength right now. She's leading by significant amounts in all polls. She is a known commodity through and through. Her name recognition is exponentially larger than that nationwide than Bernie Sanders or any of the other potential Democratic candidates. So she doesn't want to make a mistake. She doesn't want to give any of these other opponents that she has on the Democratic side any opportunity to beat her up or tear her down. And of course, you got to remember that the first caucus and primaries are months and months away, more than a half year away. So the election is so early at this point, the race is so young, that she doesn't want to follow up in a way that's going to let her challengers have some sort of advantage over her at this early juncture. On the other hand, very briefly, though, she does run the risk by taking that strategy, which appears to be her strategy, and in alienating people, people feeling that she's being too distant, that she's not engaging with them in a genuine sort of way. She's talked a lot about trying to run a campaign that's going to connect with, quote, everyday people, but it remains to be seen whether she's truly going to have success in that regard. So she has to walk a pretty careful line here between not giving her opponents an opportunity to gain on her, but also to not get people angry or turn people off because she doesn't seem to be engaging with them well enough.
Well, let's hope that the sexism is stamped out. A lot of people say the racism is going to turn to sexism overnight, but let's also hope that we get information like the info you shared, your colleague shared at the Center for Public Integrity, 12 Things to Know About Hillary Clinton. Wall Street hearts Hillary. Employees of giant financial firms represented 5 of Clinton's top 10 contributors during her 2008 presidential run. Most of her donors came from K Street, Park Avenue, Broadway, and basically Wall Street. So that's an important fact to point out, Dave.
She has a long history of connections with very powerful interests. We're seeing this with the Clinton Foundation. Regardless of how you feel about it, that is her history. And she, of course, has a lot of other things in her history, too, that must be factored in as well.
Dave Leventhal is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. He leads their investigative reporting team. Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine, which focuses on solutions to some of the biggest problems of our time. She'll be speaking at the What's Possible conference, Pier 35 in San Francisco, tomorrow at noon and Sunday at 11. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Just a comment. Last night I was watching John Stewart, who made the comment. He did pretty much a take on Bernie Sanders that you all are taking, and you showed some footage of him giving a speech and you know, started off making jokes about, oh, well, he's such a wacky guy and all this stuff, and then had him come on and make a bunch of really sensible comments. And so it's good. I think John Stewart may have done a real service to the country there.
Well, thank you for calling in. We have a comment from Ruby who says, for political junkies, I'd like to recommend With All Due Respect on Bloomberg TV. She says it's my drug of choice, and John Heilman and Mark Halperin have done features with Senator Sanders. The hosts are honest and bring in various media to task, bring the media to task. She says it's a half hour on the Daily News. I think they secretly love Sanders, but don't quote me. Well, thank you for that tip, Ruby. And you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Let's talk a little bit about something you mentioned earlier, Sarah, and that is that people are really being galvanized by some of the things that Bernie Sanders is talking about, income inequality. And yes, again, focuses on solutions to these massive problems. I wonder what you think about some of these popular sentiments that we've seen over the years, the massive Keystone protests. Even though the TPP isn't getting mentioned regularly, if you look for TPP protests, they're happening all across the country. If you look at the $15 minimum wage movement, massive. There was the biggest strike at McDonald's headquarters, I believe it was last week or the week before. What are your thoughts about how they get covered in the national media?
Well, once again, I think they tend not to be. Popular uprisings are not considered important news, whereas, you know, the latest comment by some person in Washington, D.C. is, the whole he said, she said thing. It seems to be the place where the media focuses. So I think that's really unfortunate. On the other hand, Los Angeles just adopted the $15 minimum wage. That did make national news. I think there is a movement coming from the bottom up. It's not coming from the top down. I think that we often expect to see progress in Washington, D.C., and that's often the last place where the progress actually takes hold. It often comes from the bottom up, and that's one of the ways that people can be powerful that I think often gets overlooked, is when people make the change happen in their own communities. That becomes a model, and then other communities take it up. Seattle, of course, was the first, and I'm very proud to be from Seattle, which adopted the $15 minimum wage, and then to see Los Angeles do it, and to see the conversation starting to move at a national level as well.
And Dave, you're in Washington, D.C. What's your take on this?
Well, it is something that when you're in Washington, D.C., so often we're covering or paying attention to the little tick or turn of the screw in Congress, what is happening in some committee meeting, or what's happening in some effort that's going on Capitol Hill. Oftentimes, I think the trick when you're covering news in Washington, D.C. for a national audience is to, as a reporter, just get yourself out of the D.C. mindset, if you will, and rely on your experience traveling the country or where you grew up or where you lived prior to moving to D.C. And I think some of the best reporters, certainly ones who I admire the most, are able to get themselves out of that inside the beltway mentality and really speak to the public at large, as opposed to the folks who are living inside the beltway and just feeding back into the proverbial D.C. echo chamber.
And Sarah, Yes Magazine is a monthly. A lot of your stories are online. Talk a little bit about how you've been able to sort of weather this storm where we've seen so much change in the media. And how do you determine what to report on and how to keep things fresh based on what we get in the national media? And the cycle is just so quick, right? We don't even remember what happened 2 days ago sometimes.
So on your first question, we're actually a quarterly. A print magazine that's quarterly.
Oh, right, okay.
And then we also post every day online at yesmagazine.org, so there's a lot of fresh content there. But the quarterly rhythm gives us a chance to really go in depth on a topic and ask, where are there real solutions coming up? So, for example, this current issue, Make It Right, we're really going into the difficulty around the question of race and how do we start taking real steps forward. So how do we get our support? I think, we started almost 20 years ago in the basement of a rental house and just basically holding on with our fingernails and using a few old Macintosh computers and trying to figure out whether to pay the print bill or pay our salaries, in any given quarter. And we've been able to build from there. And I think the reason we've been able to do that is because we strike a chord with people who are looking for real solutions. not fluff, not just things to make you feel better, but where are people actually making the changes that are so needed right now? And what can we learn about that? And how can that also nourish our souls during a time when so much is going so badly wrong? People really do want to have the sense that other people are out there who care about the things that they mm-hmm. care about, who care about other human beings, who care about their children's future, who care about, you know, the natural world. And a lot of us do care about those things, and those concerns are not reflected in so much of the media. So we have about 5,000 people who give us little bits of contributions or big contributions. We sell magazines. We sell subscriptions online and elsewhere. We have some, but not much, foundation support. And we don't take any advertisements. We've stayed independent during a time when a lot of the rest of the media world has really been both had trouble with the advertising world, but also has to struggle for independence given that. So that's sort of our secret sauce.
And again, Yes Magazine, Alicia Garza of Black Lives Matter is on the front, and the headline is Make It Right. And Sarah Van Gelder will be speaking at the What's Possible Conference, Pier 35 in San Francisco. And she'll be speaking tomorrow at noon and Sunday at 11 at Pier 35. And Dave Leventhal is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And today we are talking about coverage of Senator Sanders. I'm sorry, my clock is broken in here and it just threw me off. We're almost out of time. Dave, we will bring you back. We want to do a show about technology. Dave has a really good story about Uber's influence on Capitol Hill and how politicians are taking Uber on a regular basis. And David Plouffe of Barack Obama's reelection campaign is now working for Uber. So Dave Leventhal, thanks so much for joining us. He's a reporter with Center for Public Integrity. Sarah Van Gelder is executive editor of Yes Magazine. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What are the dangers of drilling in the Arctic? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Ben Stewart about his new book, Don't Trust, Don't Fear, Don't Beg, The Extraordinary Story of the Arctic 30. The book chronicles the imprisonment of 30 peaceful Greenpeace activists who were thrown into a Russian prison for protesting oil drilling in the Arctic. Stewart says the Arctic is in grave danger, so what's being done to save it? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David Latulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.